So this is the fourth and final day of this four-day retreat here at the Franciscan Center. Looking at the key points of practice from the viewpoint of the Zen tradition and some wonderful Zen masters. Why is our retreat coming to an end? It's because it never existed. There was never anything called a retreat in any intrinsic real way. Things, causes and conditions came together, people came, but there was never anything called a retreat. There was just this. See, this is what's real. The retreat is just a label. And because everything is impermanent, and everything is made up of parts that are all have their own causes and conditions, we come together for these days, and then we part. In this coming together for 4 days, we have created sort of a communal causes and conditions. And yet, each of us are on our own journey in this life. We kind of came into the soup for 4 days, but now we return to other parts of our journey. That is why any changes that are affected by the causes of this retreat can only continue within your own mind stream. Because the retreat never existed, doesn't exist, and will not exist in the future. All that exists is mind. And in the case of each of us, it's each of us has our own individualized mind stream. It is this mind stream that must be understood, looked at, transformed. That is the practice that we are undertaking. And so hopefully over the course of these 4 days, that mind stream of yours has been affected. And therefore, if it came in like this, it maybe will leave a little differently. It is up to you. It is only up to you. When the Buddha, he said to his disciples, he said, these are my own paraphrasing. He said, I would love to be able to enlighten you. But he said, all I can do is give you the Dharma. All I can do is show you the way. All I can do is give you the practices. All I can do is encourage you. But awakening, the freedom from suffering, is in your hands. Now that is very wonderful to know. For those who err on the side of defeatism, for those who err on the side of self-doubt, for those who err on the side of spiritual laziness, that may not be the message we want to hear. But it is the true message. Every master from the Buddha through Bodhidharma, Wiko, Shu Yun, Han Shan, Dogen, who else? Bankei, Master Bankei. Mahakashyapa. They were all human beings just like us. Just like us. And so they are not sharing theory. They are sharing nothing but their own direct experience. Both experience in terms of their own realizations in meditative life, but also their own experience as a practitioner. So we have to take what they tell us to heart. Please do that. There was a question about cause and effect. You know, is there anything more than understanding that everything arises from cause and effect? Disbelief that there are other kinds of magic or such things that will affect us. Understanding that my current actions and thoughts can be cause of future events. Is there anything else? The other thing is to get it. You see. You know, again, you know, I can't say how many times people, even long-term practitioners who have, you know, studied the teachings, recited the teachings of impermanence ad nauseum for years and decades, have perhaps recited the five remembrances which you've all been reciting daily for years, and yet in the face of impermanence in their own life, in the lives of people around them, in the lives of the world, they are in disbelief. What does that tell you? They haven't gotten impermanence and cause and effect. When you really reflect deeply on impermanence and cause and effect, both in the, you know, analytical, reflective, contemplative way that we learn in this tradition, but also just watching your own mind and understanding, you know, from the deeper introspective meditation, that there is nothing solid or permanent at all in this world, that everything is in a constant change. But when one understands cause and effect and impermanence and all these teachings and knows the host, that which is aware of all these endless changes that are going on, then there's no reason to be in fear. There's no reason to ever despair. There's no reason to ever be resentful or angry. So when you have come to that place, then you will know that you really that's what else, to make sure we really understand impermanence and cause and effect. So before we have some concluding teachings that I want to share with you, in terms of what we have presented as teaching, and more importantly, that we've practiced during the course of these 4 days, both in terms of the fundamentals of cultivating the awakened mind, cultivating the wakeful mind, understanding how to cultivate mindfulness with form and formless, with object, without object, how to kind of develop one's concentrative abilities, and as we have done the last 2 nights, really begin to probe the mind, the nature of thoughts, the nature of self, the nature of mind. Just by simply turning in and looking directly at one's own mind, which is essentially what Zen is always getting us to do, as you learned. So, are there any questions about the practices that have been shared going forward that you're not clear how to continue? Yes. What? Well, the question is. Okay.
So, I would say yes. For me, there is harmony as long as I have my non-dual creator. strawberry yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
But the other day, Alex took the last one right in front
of me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So.
No, the funny thing is, Alex didn't even know. He looked very harmonious.
See, without even knowing it, you're creating bad karma. Yeah. Okay. So.
Dependent solely on me, so on the host. And how much is it dependent on outside events? And if there are outside events that influence the harmony of the person, how can I be a better facilitator?
Well, that's a big question. So the question originally, the simple question is about the ritual. When we did the precepts this morning, the mindfulness trainings, and there was that very, this goes back to the Buddha himself in the original monastics, where when there was a recitation, right, at the time of the Buddha, when all the monks would come together once a month to recite the Pratimoksha, their precepts, they would not undertake that unless there was harmony in the community. Okay, harmony meant there's no conflict. Right? And so that's what that question is about. Obviously, the person, we're just doing the ritual, right? Obviously, if we were in a monastic community where we live together and all that, the person who is saying yes would obviously know that, okay, right? So their answer of yes would be because they know what's going on in the community. I guess the other possibility is if you weren't in harmony, you could say, can we just stop a second? Because if you remember the ritual, after it is stated about there's harmony in the community, is that clear and complete? The community answers what? Clear and complete. So that is the community's affirmation that that statement is true and we can continue. Right? So there would be your opportunity, right? But again, I just want to talk about the ritual. You know, in terms of the ritual, it would not be in terms of your own inner disharmony, right? Okay, your own disharmony could be ongoing. All right, that's your practice. That's what you're working with. You know, if you got a thing with Alex, that he took your yogurt, you know, talk to him. You remember, one of the precepts said, resolve all conflicts. However small. Okay? I let you decide whether Alex taking your yogurt is small or large, okay? That's up to you. But you see what I'm saying? So it is in the precepts. But in terms of the harmony, it's really about the community and interpersonally, okay? Does that answer your question? I mean, I know it doesn't answer but the other one's a big one. Within yourself? I'm not clear. Oh, so, okay, I'm having a little trouble with your question. So let me try to answer. So the question is really about harmony, and does one's inner harmony affect others?
Well, it's two different. My inner harmony, the only harmony that exists in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that's all right. So that's a different question. All right. You know, if the question is the harmony within me dependent on externals? Right. One would say, if one had a deep, profound inner harmony and understanding, that it would be dependent solely on yourself. You would not be affected in any kind of dramatic way by external conditions. Obviously, that is, for most of us, not current reality. But yet, it's not unknown, right? Because there are many things that may not bother you in the slightest, right? That the person next to you, it could be the things that most bother them, you know? And so we understand that there is this person, right, that does react to things. True. I mean, when I used to do family therapy, you know, I mean, people grow up in the same family, have same mother, same father, and let, you know, somebody says, yeah, mom and dad, they were just incredibly abusive. And somebody else goes, oh, they were wonderful parents. How could that be? Because, you know, we bring a lot to the table, right? So, you know, in the very simplicity of that situation, for example, you use the example of somebody yelling at you, and of course you say, well, wouldn't I get angry, right? Or by my disharmony. Now, again, you know, I've had the experience, I remember once being in New York City, and some obviously sort of deranged, this was, must have been in the 80s something when they were deinstitutionalizing all that. You know, and I remember I was in a restaurant or something. All of a sudden, this guy comes in off the street, happens to come up, you know, I was table, and just starts yelling and cursing at me. I mean, you know, I mean, I didn't get angry. Why? Because I knew he was a sick guy. You know what I mean? I didn't take it personally. Right? So there's the same fact. Somebody is yelling at me, cursing at me, calling me all kinds of names, and I don't get angry. Right? So that shows that our perception of events does have a lot to do with our response and therefore inner harmony. So this almost goes back to causes and conditions. The more we understand that basically people, you know, we always say they should know better, but people don't know better. Why don't they know better? Because they are the servants of their conditioning. That's all. They don't know better. Right? They're puppets. Most of us are puppets. We're just puppets of our conditioning. Right? And you know, we can, I mean, obviously from a societal point of view, you have to hold people somewhat responsible for their actions. You know, I, of course, all that. But at a deeper level, you know, who's to blame? As Xu Yun said, who's to blame? You know? You know, their parents are to blame, but their parents were created by their parents. You know what I mean? I mean, who's to blame? Society's to blame? Who can I point at? Right? So all kinds of causes and conditions lead to the creation of every person, every situation. And when one understands that, one kind of has a wisdom. Right? And when there's wisdom of understanding, then compassion can come forth because you realize, you know, and Thich Nhat Hanh says it so beautifully. He says, you know, when you're in conflict with something, the first thing you say is, well, this is in relationship, is, what is it? My darling, I know you're suffering. Right? You see? Usually it's very personal. You know, how can you say that to me? Right? Other than going, wow, I see you're suffering. Because anybody who's angry is what? Is suffering. Right? So, but to see that, we have to get beyond what? Ego, self, which makes it everything about me. Right? When it's really not about me at all. Right? You see, with a deranged person, it's simple to see. We go, oh, he's just crazy. Or let's say you run into somebody in the street who's drunk, you know, really intoxicated, just saying all kinds of, you know what I mean? You go, you don't get mad, you know, because they're drunk, right? I mean, we have a way of kind of normalizing their behavior because we understand, you know, they're under the effects of some kind of intoxicant, right? That's why they're acting this way. Right? We have understanding, But somehow with other people, we don't have that understanding that they're also under the influence. Right? But it's the influence of their conditioning. And when we understand that, you know, and again, is that simple and easy? No, it takes deep practice, but it takes a commitment to beginning to see the world this way. Right? To see real deep, very deeply, how cause and effect operates in all of us. We're all the product of cause and effect. Everybody in our life is the product of cause and effect. Everybody, the good, the bad, you know. Many people have had good causes in their life, so they show up in life in a good way, right? But, you know, but we can't, you know, many of us think, oh, I'm such a good person. No, we're fortunate. We've had good causes, right? You see? Good causes in our life that have nurtured positive things within us. We have good karma. But many people don't have that, right? There are many people that their whole life only seeds of suffering, seeds of delusion have been watered in them, right? And so that's where they show up that way. They don't want to. I mean, they think, you know what I mean? I'm saying consciously, but they don't understand really what's going on with them. Right? We think we are, you know, independent operators. We're not independent operators. When we awaken and we become conscious, then we have the opportunity of becoming independent, somewhat independent operators. I mean, we're conscious and we realize there are choices in life. There are choices in how I respond, right? There are choices how I move in life, right? But for most of us, we're just, you know, we're just the product of our conditioning. Right? And so that's that. So let me share with you a couple of things. Just to kind of end on a good note here today. So this is from a master named Chin Newell. He was actually a Korean Zen master. You know, his years are 1158 to 1210. And he was the founder of the Zen sect, the Chogye Zen sect. Maybe there are several, but it's a dominant Zen sect in Korea. He only has one name, Chin Newell, Chinul. And I think there have been some translations of his, but this is just in an anthology. So this is a question. And I think this will relate to some of the things that have happened and we've talked about in this retreat. So somebody asks him, you say that the two categories of sudden enlightenment and gradual practice are guidelines followed by all the sages. If enlightenment is sudden enlightenment, what is the need for gradual practice? If practice is gradual practice, why do you speak of sudden enlightenment? Please explain the meanings of sudden and gradual further to eliminate doubts. My doubts. Is that? So that's often... Can you see? It's a good question. Okay. So this is what Master Chin Newell, and again, if I'm ignoramus in terms of pronouncing Chinese names, Korean is like, I wouldn't even dare, but it's Chinul, okay? Anybody speak Korean here? Okay. So the answer. As for sudden enlightenment, as long as ordinary people are deluded, they think their bodies are material conglomerates and their minds are random thoughts. Okay? Sound like somebody you know. They do not know that inherent essence is the true body of reality. They do not know that their own open awareness is the real Buddha. Seeking Buddha outside of mind, they run randomly from one impulse to another. Clear? Well, yeah, very clear. If a real teacher points out a way of entry for you, and for a single instant you truly turn your attention around, you will see your own original essence. And we played around with that last night. This essence originally has no afflictions. Uncontaminated wisdom is inherently complete in it. Please contemplate that. That within your own essential mind, your own Buddha mind, your own natural mind, that mind is free of all afflictions, all issues. And it is the source of uncontaminated wisdom. This is the wisdom that knows things as they really are. Our thinking mind does not understand how things really are because they're just thoughts. See, if you think about it, forgive my words, but if you think about it, when you have a thought, and let's say you have an intelligent thought, well, thoughts are just words, right? Right? And you hear them in your mind. If you were brought up in this country, you hear your thoughts in what language? English. If you were brought up in Austria, you would hear your thoughts in German. If you were brought up in Vietnam, you would hear your thoughts in Vietnamese. Okay. So we have to understand that this wisdom intelligence of our mind has nothing to do with language. Right? So that it has to be coming from something deeper. Right? I mean, like, why do you have that thought? There has to be a deeper intelligence or wisdom or a deeper delusion from which these thoughts are arising. Is that true? I mean, they have to come from somewhere. Okay. So, it is because of this innate wisdom intelligence of our knowing mind that we are capable of knowing reality as it really is. It is already here. That is something we have to fundamentally understand and stop endlessly trusting this thinking mind that got us into trouble in the first place is somehow going to figure out how to get out of it. It's a dog chasing its tail. Daryl, last night for just a moment you stopped chasing your tail. You've been chasing your tail for 60 years, more or less? Yeah. Right. In that one instant when you stopped for a moment and chasing your tail and looked directly into the essence of your mind, you saw something very different. The essence originally has no afflictions, uncontaminated wisdom is inherently complete in it. Then you are no different from the Buddhas. Thus it is called sudden enlightenment. Now we're not going to call Daryl a Buddha for a two-second insight. But we would call him a two-second Buddha. Okay, you'll take it. Good choice. Right? Is that clear? But it means that, you know, one knows that the Buddhas and the patriarch, the teachers, have not lied. And so for all of us to have even a moment, again, there are, as I said earlier, there are depths to enlightenment. There are depths to this opening. Obviously, to have an experience that lasts for some time so it can sink deeper into the marrow of our being, that will be more transformative. But even a brief insight into the nature of reality can be a significant shift in your life, because now, even just momentarily, you know it's true. You are not who you thought you were. You are not who you always identified with. You understand more clearly the difference between host and guest. Okay? Thus it is called sudden enlightenment. As for gradual practice, having suddenly realized fundamental essence no different from Buddha, beginningless mental habits are hard to get rid of at once. Okay? Is that clear? So, in a sky which clouds are always covering the sky, even though momentarily the clouds may part and the sunlight may come through in a penetrating way and the blue vastness of the sky is revealed, if the nature of the climate is cloudiness, very quickly the clouds will come back in, right? So all of us have this endless stream of conditioning, habit energy, right? That is constantly arising. Beginningless mental habits are hard to get rid of at once. Therefore, one cultivates practice based on enlightenment. Now you can base your practice on enlightenment. Now, what if you're not in? What if you haven't had that enlightenment experience, even for a moment of seeing, that your true nature, your true essence? What do you have to go on? Faith, confidence. Right? So, don't go, You know, if one has great confidence in the way, one great confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, one has great teachings, one has great trust and confidence in teachings, one can work as diligently, perhaps even more diligently than someone who says, oh, now I know, right? So, probably in the long run, this confidence is better. Again, if you have confidence, trust in the Dharma, in the teacher, in the words and all that, and then you get, validation, well, that's good, isn't it? But my sense is, everybody in this room has had validation already in their life about this Dharma practice does work, right? That should give you confidence. Please reflect on that. Therefore, one cultivates practice based on enlightenment, gradually cultivating the attainment to perfection, nurturing the embryo of sagehood to maturity. Beautiful. The embryo. The embryo has what? It has the full potential of the human being, but it's just an embryo. But if that embryo is nurtured and allowed to grow, it will eventually become a full adult. Eventually, after a long time, one becomes a sage. Therefore, it is called gradual practice. No, it is like an infant. which has all the normal faculties at birth, but as yet undeveloped. Only with the passage of years does it become an adult. So you see, the teachers are always using examples that we can go, oh yeah, I get that, yeah. Infant, all the faculties are there, but they can't, what? They can't speak. They can't reason, can't walk, they don't have bladder and bowel control, they can't feed themselves, right? I mean, babies, they can't do anything. But the potential is there. And if they are nurtured and allowed to grow, they will develop all those faculties. You know, all of us from birth had these faculties of wisdom and compassion and understanding. But, you know, the circumstances that we grew up in, you know, perhaps they were nurtured, perhaps they weren't nurtured. Right? Perhaps they were a little nurtured or intermittently nurtured, right? So therefore, we have developed the way we've developed. But whatever it was in terms of our life, from this moment on, we now know the way of practice. We all know that all the inherent good qualities of our mind are still within us, waiting to be tapped, waiting to be nurtured, so they can develop. And we can become a sage, a wise person. Everybody in this room has that potential. Why? Because everybody has the Buddha nature, with its inherent wisdom. You know, if those of you who came out of a tradition where there was a concept of sin, if there was a sin in Buddhism, it would be to doubt this. This is the primal sin, to doubt your Buddha nature and to doubt your capacity to awaken to it. This is the teaching of the Buddha. This is the teaching of all the masters for thousands of years. Any questions about a Korean Zen master from the 12th century? Yeah. Nothing's really changed, has it? No. The only difference these days is there are less of these masters around. That's the problem. But maybe there are less masters around because there are less people who would recognize them and seek them out, right? We're too busy, aren't we, with other things, other more important things. Yes?
So this recognition of no self, and, you know, causing conditions, impermanence, these discoveries that, like, does it almost make your physical and mental sensations so invalid that something like sitting in a cave staring at the wall for 9 years becomes possible? Did that not make sense?
I mean, Bodhidharma did not sit in a cave for 9 years facing a wall. That's what it looked like. He was deeply introspecting his mind. Perhaps he was cruising for 9 years in the bliss of his original nature. Okay. It was because of that he was able to sit for 9 years facing a wall.
I just believe that it's possible.
Well, of course, he did it. Many did it. I mean, you know, you could do it. You know, I mean, I think in ancient times, when life was a little rougher, less comfortable, you know, it was easier. But, yeah, I mean, right up to these times, you go to Asia, or maybe in the West, but you go to Asia, go to the mountains, there are people in caves right now.
It's just incredible to me. Like, I would never, I have no context for how that could be possible.
Have you ever gone camping?
Yeah.
Sort of like that. I mean, you know, it's just simple living. I mean, what's so extraordinary? You know, there's no central heating, you know. You gotta make your own little fire. You gotta do your own cooking. You're kind of isolated. You're in nature. I mean, just simple living. It's like camping. Except, you know, you're there for a long time.
Camping trip one time, we actually did solo. We did this thing called solo. Mm-hmm. Like, they compartmentalized us, and, like, we weren't allowed to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it drove me to madness.
Well, then I would not recommend that you go off to a cave for 9 years yet. Yeah, I mean, if you're asking, does one need a certain degree of stability and mental, yeah, I would certainly say, yeah, this is not for everybody, right? And, yeah, because you definitely would need a certain degree of mental stability and, you know, self-confidence and lots of good things and a deep practice. Yeah.
Less difficult to obtain than I think.
Yeah, give yourself a few years of practice. But yeah, people today, I mean, people are still doing 3-year retreats and, you know, long retreats. I mean, it's people just like you and I. I mean, it's not, but you know, it takes a certain degree of development and inner stability and clarity and, you know, and the capacity to be alone. I mean, a lot of people these days, even just the thought of being alone is frightening, right? Yeah, so, but, yeah, I mean, when I was in Asia, I visited several areas in Tibet and India where retreatants were living, quote-unquote, in caves, and some of the happiest people I've ever met. Simple life. Just focusing on the basics. Right? Spending their day doing, you know, practice. That's it? Good. Yeah. Anyhow, you know, give it time, all right. So let me read something else. This is from coming back to a Chinese master. I'll just spell it. Y-U with an umlaut over the U, A-N hyphen W-U. Yuan Wu. Again, he's 11th century too, the ancients. And this is from something he wrote, and it's entitled, How to Be a Householder Bodhisattva. So we are householders, and we want to be bodhisattvas. This affair is a matter for people of intelligence and some degree of wisdom, who do not consider it difficult to understand 1,000 when hearing one. I mean, these are people who can hear one thing like cause and effect or some basic and can understand how it generalizes in 1,000 different areas. It requires a stand that is solid and true and a faith confidence that is thoroughgoing. Then you can hold fast and act the master, and take all sorts of adverse and favorable situations and differing circumstances and fuse them into one whole. A whole that is like empty space, without the least obstruction, profoundly clear and empty and illuminated, never changing, even in 100 eons or 1,000 lifetimes, unitary from beginning to end. Only then do you find true peace and tranquility. Now listen, please. I have seen many people who are highly intelligent, even intellectually brilliant, but whose faculties are unstable and whose practice is shallow. They think they witness transformation in verbal statements, and they assume that there is no way to go beyond the worldly. Thus, they increase the thorns of arbitrary opinion as they show off their ability and understanding. They take advantage of their verbal agility and think that the Buddha Dharma is like this. But when situations are born from causal conditions, they cannot pass through to freedom. So they wind up endlessly vacillating back and forth. This is really a great pity. Okay? So if any of this rings true for any of us, or we know anybody like this, this is 12th century. So this is, again, nothing new under the sun here. Right? And the same warning, right, that we come to the Dharma with our intelligence, our intellectualization, our worldliness, and, you know, we gain a superficial understanding that is just sort of massaged within the context of our already existing ideas and thoughts and beliefs. And he's saying this is not Dharma. How do you know it? Because you see. You know, when this person encounters real life, real vexations, they wobble. They don't walk through it empty and aware and clear. And he says, this is a great pity. This is why the ancients went through all kinds of experiences and faced all kinds of difficulties. Even though they may face these difficulties, they never gave it a thought and took charge of their minds all the way along and made them as strong as iron or stone. Then, thus, when it came to passing through all the varieties of birth and death, they didn't waste any effort. Isn't this where the special strength and the generosity beyond emotionalism that truly great people possess? Isn't that beautiful? Isn't this where the special strength and generosity beyond emotionalism that truly great people possess? When bodhisattvas who live a householder's life cultivate the practice of home leavers, meaning practice, the kind of home leavers means, you know, these are traditionally, it is thought, you know, that, you know, it's the monks and the nuns, right, who practice the deeper practice of Buddhism. And householders, we just worship to the Buddha, right? But he says here, when householder bodhisattvas, right, when householders take up these meditation practices, these deeper practices, it is like a lotus blooming in a fire. It will always be hard to tame the will for fame, power, pleasure, position, wealth, not to mention all the myriad starting points of vexation and turmoil associated with the burning house of worldly existence. The only way is for you yourself to realize your fundamental, real, wondrous wholeness, and then reach the stage of great calm, stability, and rest. It would be best if you managed to cast off everything and be empty and ordinary. Thoroughly experience the absence of conditioned mind and observe that all phenomena are like dreams and magical illusions. Be empty all the way through, and continue on clearing out your mind according to the time and the situation. Then you will have the same correct foundation as all the great enlightened laymen and laywomen in the Buddhist tradition. And then he ends by saying, according to your own measure of power, you will transform those not yet enlightened, so you can enter together into the uncontrived and cluttered ocean of true nature. Then your life here on this earth will not have been a loss. quite beautiful. According to your own measure of power, right? So we all have different measures of power. The power of our awakened mind, the power of all these qualities, right? You know, we see in this own life, there are beings like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, like Thich Nhat Hanh, and others who have this power, right? That they can help transform thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people, right? So we all have different levels of power, right? So according to our own measure of power, we still have the ability to transform those yet not enlightened, so that all of us together can enter into the uncontrived, uncluttered ocean of our true nature. Then your life here on earth will not be a loss. So that is the advice to us across the centuries from the Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu. Yeah, so nothing to be sneezed at, these Zen masters, eh? Quite wonderful. Again, we don't grow up hearing these stories, do we? We didn't grow up hearing about these types of people, this kind of life. Right? We didn't hear about being a bodhisattva. We never heard about our true nature, still uncluttered and pure. We didn't hear about that there's a very simple, pragmatic way to facilitate this transformation and awakening. Right? We never heard that the greatest gift that we can give another human being is to give them the tools to liberate themselves from all their suffering. Right? But now we have. So it is up to each of us, you know, to do with this as we will. If there are many people in this world who, because of their good karma, gain wealth, right? Some wealth, we know these days, you know, to be even a billionaire is kind of, you know, so what? You know, so we know people, because of their good karma, their good fortune, whatever you want to call it, they can gain wealth. But then what do they do with it, you see? What do they do with it? In the same way, when we come to the Dharma, when we're able to hear these kinds of teachings, when we're able to be part of a community, when we're able to, you know, do all the things we're doing, you know, we are receiving great wealth in these teachings. The question is, what are we going to do with it? Right? Are we going to fritter it away? Right? Are we going to keep it in the bank? Check our statements every month? Check our portfolio every month? Is that what we're going to do with our wealth? Buy things just for us? Is that what we're going to do with our wealth? Right? I mean, people who have wealth have great opportunity to bring great benefit to many people, don't they? So there's all kinds of wealth. I guess what I'm saying right now, you know, we have been given a great, you know, we've been given a great wealth here, a great jewel, something of great value in this Dharma, in these teachings. You know, it's interesting, we'll have to end in a minute, you know, Master Bunke, who I quoted a little bit last night, he was a very interesting guy. He practiced so hard. He went through so many austerities, so much pain and suffering he practiced until he had his great awakening. Right? And after that, as you heard last night, he taught a very simple dharma, right? About the unborn original mind. Very simple dharma. And he was such a popular teacher. I mean, not just intellectuals and monks and lay people, but he taught all kinds of farmers and common people and peasants came to him because he taught in such a simple, direct way. And if you read his teachings or his life, people would say, but hold on, you practice so hard, right? You went through so much difficulty. You know, why are you saying that this is so easy? And he said, I didn't know better. It's really quite beautiful. He said, I didn't know better. Right? Now I know better. I know it's right here, that I never left it. And all that incredible hardship that I went through, you don't need to go through. Right? He said it's like, if you were a group of people and you were lost in the woods and you looking for a water source and you sent somebody out. And they had to kind of go through all kinds of hardship in territory that was totally uncharted, right? All kinds of difficulties. And then they finally found the spring, right? When they come back to their group of people, they just tell them where the spring is, right? They don't have to tell them you have to go up here and you have to fall down the mountain and then you have to trip and then you have to dig 20 times and not find anything. You see, he says it, and that's what Zona said. He said, it's like that, it's like, he said, that's all I'm doing. Right? I'm telling you where the spring is. Thank you.